Good afternoon. So I'll start off with an exercise about pipes, which we finished up basically last time. So here I have some code where we make a pipe, we call fork, we close the readin of the pipe in the child, and then write 0, 1, all the way up to 9, and then exit. And in the parent, we close the write end and read with a buffer with 10 bytes in it, with an argument of 10, and then we print out the contents of that buffer up to the count that was read. And the question is, well, what are we going to get out? Are we going to get out everything that the child wrote? Are we going to get out just the first thing? Are we going to possibly get out nothing or some combination of these? Give you some time to think about that. You can check with your neighbor, and then we'll see what you think. So who thinks A, B, C, D, E, F? Okay, so I agree with the plurality, but I think D is correct. So first, let's talk about why multiple things are possible. And the issue is we have these writes running alongside the reads. And the question is, well, how fast does the child execute versus the parent? Does it get to run the whole thing before the parent gets to call read or not? And that depends on if we have multiple cores, how fast the two cores run. If we don't have multiple cores, when do we switch between the two programs? When do timer interrupts happen? And that can vary a lot. So we could have the case where we manage to write 0 through 9, and the read happens after that, in which case we'll get everything. We could have the read happen just after we write 0, in which case we could get B, or we could have it happen somewhere in between, in which case we get something between 0 and 0 through 9. Now, then there's the question about nothing, and it seems like, well, wait, let's say that all these writes happen, let's say the read happens like way up here. The read happens before the child has to do anything. It would be sensible for the read to return nothing. But POSIX has made a decision that that wouldn't be useful. They decided if you're calling read on a pipe, we're going to wait until there's something for you to read. So that it won't return nothing. It will wait for something to be written or the pipe to be closed. And something's written, so it's going to return at least 0. So questions, can I figure this out? And if you tried this empirically, here's the distribution I got on my laptop from 1,000 trials. So you see, yeah, really, in fact, everything is possible. It just depends on how the timing works out, because there's this sort of apparent randomness in how fast does the parent and child run, and when exactly are they run, and so on. And our main topic for today, as we move on from talking about the POSIX API, is talking about, well, how do we choose when we run the child versus the parent? You know, and since we see, like, everything happens. So, get to that. Before I finish reviewing last time, just a logistics note. I noticed that the submission site has links to the assignments. Those links went to the wrong semester, which would have been pretty obvious because there's a big header on the last semester's website saying it's not for this semester. I think most people didn't notice that, but that's fixed. Also, I received an anonymous feedback suggesting someone was having trouble finding the Piazza that I did create for this course, which should have been linked above the anonymous feedback button, which works for me, maybe it doesn't work for everyone. I also put a direct link on the course webpage, so if you can't find it there, that should work. If not, let me know. That should be accessible. And now that we're finishing up with the Unix API, I'm going to, you know, mention what we talked about, just to view it. So in case we have any final questions before we go to a different topic. Talking about how we spawn processes, and the Unix API made this kind of strange choice of saying, when we make a new process, we're going to copy an existing one. We're going to do something special for the first process. In fact, later today we'll talk about what that is for XV6. But otherwise, we're copying an existing process. And if you don't want to run the same program, there's a separate system call which replaces a process with a new one, but uses the same process control block. And sometimes you want to wait for a program to finish. Like you run a command, you want to have the command finish before you ask for the next command. And we have a system call waitPID, which can wait for a process you created to exit. Talk about files. And we have this unifying feature that we have this open a file to create it. And we saw that, well, it's not always open. So pipes are files, but they are created with the pipe function instead of open. But it's the same idea that we have this setup function before we can use the file. And then once we've set it up, we can do read and writes. And when we're done with it, we call close. And to determine which file we've set up that we're referring to, we have this array of what we call file descriptors for every process. And the way we figured out where our output usually went and where our input usually came from was we just had a convention that index 0 was input, index 1 was the normal output, index 2 was the normal error output. And we saw that in addition to having these indices, we had ways of manipulating these indices. And this is how we would tell a program, hey, you're outputting through this file instead of the terminal, is we change what that index was before we ran the program, using a function like dupe2. So before I move on from talking about the POSIX API, any questions about these things we covered in the last week? Okay. So our main topic for today is going to be about sort of more under the hood, how do we choose what programs to run? And the first step in that is we have to keep track of what programs are active. And in XV6, this means we have to know about all the process control blocks. And this is how they're kept track of in XV6. We have this struct called ptable, which contains a lock. We'll talk about what that is in a second. And an array of processes, struct procs, process control blocks. And it's of a size, so this is a fixed constant. That's the number of process control blocks XV6 has. If you want to run more processes than that at once, too bad. You have to change that constant and recompile. So obviously, in a more commercial OS, that might not be an acceptable strategy, but keeps things simple in XV6. So that's what they've done. I think that's like 32 or something like that. And that's just all the processes. And we have this lock. So the purpose of the lock, and we'll talk a lot more about this later, so I'm just giving the high-level overview. But the purpose of the lock is to make sure only one thing at a time tries to access the list of processes to change, for example, what processes are runnable. A reason this is a concern is that we have things like timer interrupts that try to change what processes are runnable. And we don't want it to be the case that we're deciding to choose a different process to run, and while we're doing that, a timer interrupt happens and makes a different decision about which process to run. And as a result, we're confused about what process we're running next. So to prevent that, we're going to have one thing at a time manipulate the states of processes, whether they're runnable or not runnable, and so on. And this lock is going to let us do that. So one of the things the lock is going to do is even on a single core, it's going to keep things from like timer interrupts from happening while we're manipulating the list of processes. And on a multi-core, it's also going to keep other cores from manipulating that while we're deciding what to run. So we have this list of processes. How do we get something in here? Well, we have to choose an index of this list of processes to use. And this is the code XV6 uses for that. It just looks through the list and finds something that is marked as unused and takes it. And it does this with the lock, so it knows that no one else is trying to do the same thing at the same time, so we aren't confused about who owns that entry of the array. And sometimes this won't work. You might say, well, yeah, we could run out of entries in the array. In that case, fork fails. So that's how we get an entry. Now, there's one detail that we kind of glossed over when we talked about fork, which is that, well, we have to have a first process. So XV6 needs to have a way of having a first process. And part of that is going to use this to allocate an entry in the array, probably going to be the first one, because that should be unused when we boot. But we also need to set up that first process to run something useful. And the way XV6 does that is that they've hard-coded the first program that runs, the machine code for it, inside the kernel. So they have this hard-coded array, which is just the machine code for the first program to run. And they create a process for it and then set up its memory to contain that hard code. And this hard-coded machine code, you might ask, well, what does it do? It just execvs /init. So /init is a normal application that just gets run at boot. And the one that comes with XV6, what that does is it sets up the console so you can print out and then starts the shell. This is how we get our first program running. We just have it hard-coded. Now, we've loaded the code, but that's not enough to actually run the program. So we also need to set up, where does execution start? It starts at byte 0, address 0, and we have to set up a stack pointer. So that's just done by hand. And there's a last step, which is very important, is that we need to say that it's runnable. So it started as unused or something like that, and now we need to mark it as runnable. And then there's going to be code later on that we're going to look at later today that's going to look at the list of processes and figure out, oh, this is runnable, I should run it. XV6 has made a choice that we're not going to actually switch right away to the thing we marked as runnable. We're going to wait until we come to a point where we want to run something. And then we're going to find something we can run. And because we said this is runnable, we're going to find this. Okay. Some questions about our first process? Yeah. Where is this? Question is, where is this in the source code? I think it's in proc.c.
So which function is the caller function of this function?
Whose question was function the caller function? I do not remember offhand. This is something which is run on boot.
So what decides what's going to run on boot?
The question is, what decides what runs on boot? So there's some code which is run when the XV6 OS loads, like the processor jumps to a particular place, and there's code which loads the rest of the OS, and then it jumps to a particular place, and that stuff it loads.
Is it something that happens when we make?
The question is, this something that happens when we make? So this happens every time we boot the simulator.
Okay.
So this is part of the boot process, is doing this. So basically, there's the equivalent of a main function, but for the kernel. And this is part of what that calls, directly or indirectly. Other questions? OK. So we're going to spend most of the rest of the day talking about how we decide to run programs or not run programs. And to do that in XV6, we need to talk about threads versus processes, which we've kind of glossed over a bit. So in XV6, each process has exactly one thread. Most more featureful OSs relax this restriction, and each process has one or more threads. And we'll go back to that scenario later, but for now, we're going to do each process is one thread, and we, in our textbooks, are going to talk about thread scheduling, not process scheduling. We're going to choose which thread we run, not which process we run. But in XV6, the code looks like it's scheduling processes because there's a one-to-one relationship. But when we don't have that one-to-one relationship, we're going to care about the threads, not the processes. And the thread is the stuff that you put on the CPU. So it's the save register values. Each thread has its own stack pointer. Therefore, it conceptually has its own stack, which means probably there's separate memory for each thread for the stack and a program counter. And the rest of the stuff might be shared between multiple threads. Now, since these are grouped together in XV6, there's a bunch of stuff in the process control block, which is really per-thread information. And if we modified XV6 to support multiple threads per process, we'd have multiple copies of all this stuff. We'd have separate kernel stacks for every thread. We'd have separate states, whether it's running or runnable or waiting, for every thread. We'd have separate saved registers for every thread, and so on. But since these are grouped together, these are all grouped with the process information, including like the memory that's allocated in the open files, which would be shared between threads. Sort of a pictorial way of thinking about this is that XV6 has these single-threaded processes where we have our files, our PID, and other process control block data, and our data in memory, like our code and our global variables, all together with one stack and the registers and the program counter and so on. Whereas in a multi-threaded process, we duplicate this per-thread stuff, this stack and registers and program counter, but we share the same files between those threads and the same PID and the same code and global variables and so on. So we'll go into a lot more detail later in the semester about how programming with threads work, but we're mentioning it now just to point out that the thing we're talking about running on the CPU is really threads. So later on, when we actually have multi-threaded processes, that's what we're actually scheduling, not processes. But questions about multi-threaded processes versus single-threaded processes? Okay. So if we're thinking about threads, we can think about them going through a little state machine. So our threads start out as new threads, and I've given sort of generic names and the names of the constant for the state variable in XV6 here, where it's being created, but it's not ready to run yet. So this is like just while fork is running, we're in this state, we're setting up the process to run, and then they become what we'll call ready. And by ready, I mean we can right now put it on a CPU, it's just not on one. Like its registers are saved, but we could move them onto a CPU and start running it right away. So things that are ready will transition to actually running. When they're actually on the CPU, actually the active registers, active stack pointer, active program counter on a core. And from that point, there's two things which could happen. Maybe it runs for too long and we decide to run something else. In that case, it could go from running to ready again. Just ran for too long, but we can still keep running it. We just might have chosen to run something else instead. Or it could, for some reason, need something external to happen. Like we could be waiting for a key press, could be waiting for a certain amount of time to pass, and so on. But something needs to happen for it to be runnable, so we'll say it's waiting, or XV6's term is sleeping. And this means that we're waiting for something to happen before we can actually schedule it. Like if it asks to read a key press, we can't run it until the key gets pressed. You know, there's nothing for it to do until the key gets pressed. And we have a final state here of finished. So this is what happens when the program calls exit, goes to this finished state. And since we have this wait function, and remember I said that wait retrieves the exit status even if it already exited, so we have to keep some information about the program around after it exits. That's why we still keep it around in this state. We don't just delete it. So we can wait for it. So in XV6, the name for this state is zombie because it's one of those quote-unquote zombie processes that haven't been cleaned up yet, because we need to wait for it to get its exit status. Yes?
When would it go from running to ready without going through waiting?
The question is, when would it go from running to ready? So for example, if I write an infinite loop and I have another program I want to run, the OS is going to switch away from my infinite loop to run that other program for a little bit. And that would be a case where the infinite loop goes from running to ready. Yes?
Can you kill a thread at any time? So can you kill a thread while it's waiting and make it go to finish?
The question is, can I make a thread, kill a thread and make it go to finish? Yes. So I don't know. So many OSs allow this transition. I believe XV6 actually, when you kill a program, it runs it and then makes it finish. But many OSs do allow that direct transition of that you can kill something which is ready or kill something which is finished, which is waiting. Other questions? Okay. So this is a view which is from the point of view of the thread. And we can have a more system level point of view where we think of having what I'll call queues of threads. So we have what we'll call a ready queue, which is a list of threads that we could run right now. And we'll have also other queues. We'll have queues for each I/O device. So I've only shown one in this picture, but I have plural queues. So we'll have a queue to access the disk, a queue to access the network, and so on. And you know, we'll have to decide what order we do that in. And we'll have queues of things that are waiting for some event to happen. We can think of these as lists of threads that we manage. And I say queues here. These queues are not going to be first in, first out. In fact, it's going to be a very important question, like, how do I order this queue, or what do I take first off the queue? And that's going to be what we're going to spend a lot of time on, is particularly talking about this ready queue. Like, I have four different things I can run. Which one do I choose? Now, this list of threads that we can do things with, this is a very common thing for OSs to do. XV6 doesn't seem to do it. There's no queue, class, or structs. Instead, XV6 kind of represents these queues implicitly, that the list of processes that are ready to run, if you want to get that, you iterate through the entire array of processes and check each one to see if it's marked as runnable. The list of things which are waiting to use the disk, you iterate through the entire array of processes and check which ones are marked as sleeping and marked as sleeping for the disk, and so on. In real OSs, they don't do this. So the reason XV6 has this sort of no real explicit queues is because it's simpler, right? You have to track the state in the process anyways. Minus will not keep two copies of it. But in real OSs, they say, wait, if I have to scan the list of processes every time I want to find any process, that's really slow. So they have a separate data structure to make that faster. Okay. So our next big topic is going to be about scheduling. So scheduling is the action for the CPU of removing something from that queue. And also, we'll talk sometimes about scheduling for things which aren't the CPU. Like if I'm scheduling disk I/O, we have a bunch of things waiting to do disk I/O, choosing which one to run. So again, it's just removing from a queue. That's our scheduling. And we're almost entirely going to talk about scheduling with the ready queue, things that are waiting to use the CPU. But there are other scheduling problems I want you to be thinking about. So for example, I'm going to talk about like running things on the CPU on the order of milliseconds. But if we have, say, a scientific computing sort of workload and we have a big supercomputer, those people run things which run for hours. And then you decide which of these 10 different things scientists have submitted do I run first. That's the same type of scheduling problem. And many of the same ideas will apply, even though we'll have different goals. And therefore, the best solution is going to look very different than what we're going to come up with for our CPU scheduling based on things like timer interrupts. And even though this batch scheduling deals with the CPU, there's going to be big differences in addition to the time scale. Like, if we're thinking about those programs, typically it's going to be the case that we can't switch between them rapidly because we like need to save all the data to disk, which might take minutes. That's not going to be the scenario we have on a desktop where we can switch between programs without saving data that's just all in memory. And there's a similar problem for I/O scheduling. If I have a disk or a network, I can decide, well, I have three different programs trying to read a file on disk. Which program gets to read first? That's another scheduling decision. So we're not going to talk very explicitly about these decisions, but when I go over the things for CPU scheduling, a lot of the ideas will still apply, especially when I'm talking about the simpler and more generic things. Now we're going to go into some things focused more on the particular idea of I have a desktop machine or a laptop or something like that, and I want to do good scheduling for that, where we'll be further away. And our main target is going to be CPU scheduling, so user scheduling the CPU. And not just for any system, not for those sort of big scientific simulation workloads. We're talking about like something where programs do a lot of I/O. You might say, that seems unusual, but no, that's common. So a program does a lot of I/O, think your web browser does a lot of I/O. Talks to the network, talks to the mouse, talks to the keyboard, does tons of I/O. Your shell does tons of I/O. So these are our typical desktop and laptop workloads. All have this sort of property. And when we're doing I/O, remember when we talked about exceptions, I said that the device tells us when the OS has to do something. So the way I/O typically works is we say, OK, here disk, here's something for the disk to do. Now I could run something else while the disk is doing that, and it will give me an exception when it's done. And this means I can run other programs while waiting for the I/O. And that's where we're going to have why we're going to have interesting scheduling decisions, is that we're going to want to alternate what's running in the, you know, run things in the, while other programs are doing I/O. That's where we're going to get time. Also, I have this last most unrealistic thing about the scenario we'll talk about. We're going to talk about single core scheduling. And you might say, well, that doesn't reflect any of the systems I have, and that's commonly true these days. But the principles we apply for a single core, many of them will extend to multi-core. We're probably not going to talk this semester very explicitly about how we do multi-core scheduling, but most of the problems are sort of taking what we do on single core and figuring out what parts don't work so well in multi-core. And a thing we're going to spend most of our time on, but not today, is on scheduling policy. So the policy decision is what do we remove from the queue? What do we run next? But first, I'm going to look at the mechanism in the case of Xv6. So we're going to look at how does Xv6's scheduler work? And when you look at how Xv6's scheduler work, this policy question is not going to be very apparent. It's going to look like Xv6's scheduler doesn't have a policy, but it really does. It has made a particular policy choice. It's just kind of hard-coded and not a clear decision as so much as they did the simplest thing and this is what they ended up with. But they've made a choice by doing that makes particular choices be made. And we're going to talk about, and you know, over the next few days, like what that means for how good Xv6's scheduler is for like using it as a desktop. So let's talk about, as I said, the mechanism of Xv6's scheduler. So Xv6 uses this design to simplify the code of having the scheduler run as a separate thread on each core. So I talked about every process has a thread. There's an additional thread that's not part of any process that Xv6 runs for each core, which is the scheduler. And this is just to keep things convenient. And the scheduler runs this infinite loop. in the infinite loop, it chooses a thread to switch to. It switches to that thread. And when that thread is done running, we'll talk about some examples of how it could be done running, it gets switched back to, goes back to the beginning of the loop, chooses another thread to switch to, and so on. And the program threads, the actual processes, they run for a while, and they switch back to the scheduler thread, and eventually the scheduler thread switches back to them, assuming they're runnable eventually. So let's look at this infinite loop. So here's the infinite loop. This is the scheduler function. This gets run, you know, whole time, once per core. And this is going to, we have a loop, inner loop in here, we switch to a thread, we switch back, and we keep going. So the first thing which happens in this loop is STI, which is the name of the enable interrupts instruction. So throughout much of this loop, we'll have disabled interrupts. And the reason why is we don't want something like a timer interrupt to interfere with us scanning through the list of processes to find something that's runnable. We don't want that to change. So we disable interrupts with this acquire and release pair of operations. So this keeps anything from interfering with processes being runnable or not, including stopping timer interrupts and keyboard interrupts. But we need to have some way of making sure, even though we've stopped timer and keyboard interrupts, that they still happen. So this is where that's going to happen. We enable them. So if there's a timer interrupt pending or a key press happened, we'll handle it. And the handler for the interrupt will mark a thread as runnable, so we'll find it later in that loop that's down there. So then I have our loop here. And what this does is it iterates through that array of all the processes and finds runnable ones. So we skip over non-runnable ones. And just in order, we switch to each runnable process. So we switch to it. It's going to run for a bit. Then it's going to switch back here. And then we're going to go finish clean up from switching to it and find the next runnable process in the list. Sometimes we'll be at the last runnable process in the list, in which case we'll go to the bottom of this main loop and go back from the beginning. So we run the first process in the list, then the next one, until we get to the end, and then we go back to the beginning. And that's what the scheduler code does. Okay. Some questions? Yes?
What are some things that would try to access the P table?
The question is, what are the things that would try to access the P table that we're locking to prevent? So one example is a timer or keyboard interrupt. It would change what programs are running or runnable, and we're checking that in the loop, so we don't want that to happen at the same time. Is that okay? Question? Yes.
After you switch, is the P table still locked?
Question: after we switch, is the P table still locked? Yes, and I'll talk about what happens about that in a second. Other questions? Yes.
Is this specific to the XP6 scheduler? It arbitrarily just goes through the list of runnable processes, or?
Question: is this choice of how we choose what process specific to the XP6 scheduler? Yes. This is, as it turns out, this is an example of a very common scheduling policy. But it happens to just be hard coded in this code. Other questions? Okay. So I have some code around this switch to the process that I have omitted. I'm going to show that here. So there's some bookkeeping the scheduler does, which is important. So one piece of bookkeeping is it updates the information for my proc. So when we have a system call, we can figure out what program was running. And this is something we need later on. Also, we have to actually set up to run a particular process. So there's two parts to that. So one is we need to switch to the address space of that process, meaning that we want to have in the user part of memory that program loaded. So that's what switch UVM does. And we also set it as running. So later on, or on other cores, since XV6 supports multiple cores, we don't try to run it again. So remember, it's running. So then we have our actual switch. And after that, we have this switch KVM. So this changes away from the address space of the user process. This is to an address space with only kernel stuff in it. This is just in case we like killed the program, we don't want to have pointers to invalid memory. We also have some bookkeeping to remember that we aren't running any programs right now. So like if we have a timer interrupt happens, we don't get confused and think, oh, I need to switch away from the current program. We can realize, wait a moment, nothing's running. That's bookkeeping, so we remember that, that cproc equals zero. Makes my proc return null. So questions about this code? Yes.
Is C CPU?
So the question is C CPU? Yes. So C is the current CPU. Sorry. Yes. C is current.
Current
CPU core. Yeah. And when I say CPU in this class, I almost always mean core. I probably should just say core, but haven't cleaned that up. Yeah, so this is the current core. So my proc basically accesses this for depending on what core you're running on. Yeah?
While it's locked, are interrupts like queued and then they go in order?
The question is, what happens to interrupts while we have this lock? Yes, so are they queued? And they're basically queued. The processor, when interrupts are re-enabled, will run interrupt handlers in some order. And generally, we'll only run each type of interrupt handler once. Okay. Other questions? Okay, yeah.
Is the scheduler process in the ptable?
The question is the scheduler process in the ptable. No, it is not a process. It is a thread, but it's not a process. So it's special. So as for the scheduler, like where do you find it? This is a hint. It's in the per CPU. So this is like my CPU scheduler. That's how we know, that's how other code is going to switch to it. So I showed you the scheduler code, and we have to switch to and from it. So how does that work? And our basic procedure from elsewhere is that when we want to switch to the scheduler, we're going to first acquire the process table lock. So there's two reasons for this. So one reason is that the scheduler expects the process table lock to be held when you switch to it. And we can see that because the code I just showed you releases it, or releases the lock and therefore re-enables interrupts afterwards. Another reason is that we're going to change what's running and runnable, and we don't want a timer interrupt or something to do something contradictory. You know, if we're marking our current process as waiting, we don't want the timer interrupt to mark it as runnable. So we need to make sure there's no interference there. So we acquire the process table lock to prevent that, and then we mark the current process as not running, so the scheduler doesn't think it's still running and maybe could switch to it if it's runnable, or doesn't switch to it if it's not. And then we switch to the scheduler thread. So that's the switching to the scheduler thread. And after we do that, sometime later when we're runnable, the scheduler will switch back to us. And when it does this, the process table lock is held, because and meaning slash interrupts are disabled. And we need to undo that. So interrupts are disabled because we don't want anything interfering with the switch. And so that's why we want to do that. And we have the process table lock held as part of that. So that's going to be something we have to undo. And that's going to happen in our code, which switches to and from the scheduler. So I'll give an example of this code that switches back with the case where we started a program and it became ready, and what happens the first time it runs. So this is in fork ret, which is handles returning from fork for the new process. So that we had a new process, we set it as ready, and now it's starting running. So the scheduler decided to run it. The scheduler ends up switching into here, and this finishes setting up the process and releases the process table lock, re-enables interrupts, so timer interrupts can happen again. And then we move on with the new program. So questions? Yes? So another case, that's one of the simpler ones, is where we have to switch to and also from the scheduler is on the timer interrupts. And when I showed you the timer interrupt code earlier, I showed you that it calls this yield function. So let's look at the yield function. This is the yield function. So it locks the table of processes, disables interrupts, so we don't have anyone interfering with us when we set the current program as runnable and not running. Then we have this sched function, and this is just a wrapper around a switch call. So this switches to the correct scheduler thread. So we start running the scheduler in the middle of its loop. And the scheduler is going to look for another thing to run, switch to that, and eventually it will come back to this still runnable thread. And when it does that, it's going to switch back and will release the process table lock. So it will switch back to where we switch to the scheduler, switch back to us, we'll release the lock, return from yield, finish the timer interrupt in the common case, and go back to the program. So questions? This works. Okay. So this is sort of was showing the transition from ready to running and back again. So we also can talk about, well, how do we put a thread to sleep? So I have a thread which was previously runnable and it does something like ask to read from the keyboard. There's no keyboard input yet. So we call this sleep function, which takes this chan argument, which is just a marker to say, what are you waiting for? And what this does is it first gets exclusive access to the process table, make sure nothing, no timer interrupt interferes. And then it remembers, okay, this process was waiting for this particular type of event. If it was a keyboard key press, there would be a pointer indicating the keyboard and mark it as sleeping, and then switch to the scheduler. The scheduler will look for something that it can run. Won't be this program right away. But eventually that key press will happen, and somehow will be marked as runnable. And when that happens, the scheduler will switch back and will return and keep executing, you know, perhaps finishing the read that we were waiting for a key press for. Questions about this code? Here. So here we're just marking the program as sleeping, calling the scheduler, and something else is going to have to run to make it runnable again, because the scheduler only runs runnable things. And here's the code which does that. So there's a wake up function. And this just does this transition. It transitions from waiting to ready. So notice that we don't go directly to running. This is the design choice XV6 has made, that we just switch it to ready and let something else later on discover that it can be run. And this is done by just saying, hey, there was a key press, we'll have the pointer for a key press, and we'll just scan for a process that was waiting for a key press and mark it as runnable. Okay. So questions? Let's code. Okay. So that's the mechanics of how the XV6 scheduler works. and if you were paying attention to like the scheduler layout, we saw the policy the scheduler uses. So the scheduler makes some weird choices from a perspective of what other OSs do. A big one is x86 uses the separate scheduler thread. And that's convenient in a certain way. The big convenience is that the scheduler has some state, some things it's tracking, which is what process are we on, so it can look for the next process in the table of processes. And this is just kept on the stack of the scheduler thread. But other OSs commonly don't have a scheduler thread. They just have a function which finds the next thing to run and switches directly to it. And this is faster because XV6, we're doing two thread switches. We're switching to the scheduler, then to something else every time we want to change what we're running, where we could do just one. But the bookkeeping is a little more awkward. We need to keep track of that pointer P, that process we're scanning right now, somewhere else. And so XV6, to keep things simpler, doesn't do that. But this is a little slower, and many commercial OSs really care about how fast switching between two user threads is, and so that don't find that acceptable. The other things XV6 does is that it scans the process list to find sleeping and waiting threads. So if we want to find a thread that is runnable, we just look through all the processes. Obviously, that performance doesn't scale if you have like 1,000 processes and 10 of them are runnable. That's really inefficient. That's a common situation for a modern like desktop OS. Also, the state tracking code, the stuff that like deals with actually changing to the correct program and marking it as runnable or running, and the scheduler is very tightly integrated with the decision of what do we run next. And it turns out that we're going to want to be more intelligent about what we run next, and most OSs will organize that code to separate these two things so they can change the decision about what to run next without rewriting that code, which like tracks the value for my proc and so on. But XV6 is just keeping things simple, so they hard-coded their scheduling policy. And talked about XV6's scheduling policy. So the description of the policy is we look for the next process in the process list and just run it. But you might think, well, that's probably not the best thing to do. Now, whether it is or not actually depends on, well, what do we care about? If I care about having the simplest possible OS, maybe this is the best policy. But we often have other things we care about, like performance or something like that. We'll talk about what several of those are. And we're going to have a lot of discussion about this, so we're going to have some set of assumptions to understand what do we care about for running programs, how are we running programs, and so on. And I'm going to mostly be speaking from maybe a rather antiquated set of assumptions. And this is because this is when most of the literature on CPU scheduling was originally written, was like in the 70s or the 60s, when we had one program per user most of the time, and machines that were shared between users, and one thread for each of those programs. And the programs were mostly independent, therefore. And all of these are very false on a modern desktop. We typically have many programs for one user and not multiple users. Like, we have like multiple threads per program. Like, our web browser has several threads, probably. The programs aren't independent. Like, my web browser is writing something out that my PDF viewer is reading. There's connections there that might matter. We're going to ignore that and look at this nice 1970s shared mainframe view of the world. And in that view, the way programs work is there's a single thread, the user types their input in, or otherwise the program gets its input, like, I'm using a terminal, like we read from the terminal, it figures out, oh, this is the, you know, waits to read from the terminal, it figures out, oh, you want to open that file, then it starts opening that file, then it reads from that file, waits for that to happen. And the result of this, these sorts of things is that we have this alternating, the program is either waiting for I/O, keyboard import, network input, disk I/O, or doing a little bit of computation that it could only do once it finished the last piece of I/O. So with the shell, it's waiting for a key press before it can do anything related to like the little bit of computation to actually figure out what program to start, to set up the arguments, and so on. For like a drawing program, it's waiting to get, you know, mouse or tablet input so it knows what to put on the screen, then it computes what to put on the screen, and then it's done until we get the next piece of input. Or web browser, like it's first waiting for me to click somewhere, and then it's waiting for a web server to respond. But either way, we have these loops of the program does a little bit of work to figure out, you know, what I/O to do next, and then waits for more input. And we'll call these little bits of work CPU bursts. And this is what we're going to be concerned about scheduling. So we're going to imagine that we have several programs which are ready to run a little burst of CPU. And the scheduling problem we're going to mostly be concerned with is, well, if I have four of them, which one do I run first? And for the most part, to keep things simpler, we're going to assume all the programs become ready at once, even though we know that's not really the case. But the scheduling problem is only interesting when we have several programs to choose between. So if we imagine our programs are composed of these CPU bursts, and this is an assumption which mostly works on modern desktops, let's say, what do those look like? You know, are we just like doing like little bits of I/O? Is it long? Does it vary? And this is something we can measure empirically. So here are some measurements from 1966. So they had a shared system, and they measured the time from when you typed a command in their shell to when it finished. And these measurements are in ticks, which are 16 milliseconds or so. So the median time was between 16 and 30 milliseconds, but we have this long tail of things which take way, way, way longer. And both of those are significant. And you might say, why are you showing me data from 1966? Programs don't look like this anymore. But we still have this general pattern. And you can see this is a log scale here, of that most of the things are short, but we have this long tail of things which take much, 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 much longer. And that's what we're going to deal with scheduling. And this is going to affect what type of schedulers we think are good ideas. And this pattern persists, so I don't have recent data because it's hard to find someone who's collected this sort of thing recently, and it's more challenging on a multi-core. But here's 1990 data, and it looks kind of different at a high level, but note that these are buckets which are roughly log scale, so what this says is most things take like a couple milliseconds, but we have this tail of a significant number of things which take many seconds. And that's sort of typically the pattern we end up dealing with on something like a desktop or a laptop or a mobile phone, is that sort of pattern of most things are really short, but we have a bunch of things which take way, way, way longer. That, you know, there's not many of them, but they're going to be significant as far as what our scheduler has to worry about. But the typical thing is we have these short CPU bursts followed by I/O of at least milliseconds. So our view, we're going to schedule these CPU bursts, and we're going to assume we just have a bunch of them ready to run. The question is, what do we do next? Okay. So to decide what do we do on next, we need to talk about metrics. We need to say, well, if we have this choice, what makes sense to run? And we're going to have several metrics we'll look at. So before I start talking about these metrics, questions about the CPU burst model. It's going to be important, especially for this first metric we'll talk about. The idea that our programs alternate between CPU and not CPU. Okay. So first metric I'm going to talk about is known as either response time or turnaround time. I'm going to use, for reasons I'll explain in a bit, the term turnaround time. And turnaround time, we can think of for CPU bursts at the time from when you like press a key to when you see something on the screen. It's the time from when the program was ready to run until when it finished. And if we have multiple programs, we have to figure out, well, I have the turnaround time for each program. How do I put those together? We'll usually use the sum or the mean. But you might observe maybe that's not the best choice. But that's usually what we use because it makes the analysis easier, not because it makes necessarily for better schedulers. So another metric is throughput. And this is the total work per second. And you might say, wait, we're always using the CPU unless there's not enough work to do. Why was this even a metric? And the issue is going to be time that the CPU is not doing something useful, what we'll call overhead. And the biggest source of overhead is going to be context switching. And when I talk about context switching, I don't just mean the actual time we spend saving registers and restoring them. I also mean that we have cold caches, that if I run program A and it stores everything in the main CPU cache, and I run program B for a while and switch back to A, well, now A has less stuff cached than if we just kept running A. So that's a loss of throughput, less useful work done, even though we use the same amount of time. And in the extreme case, if we just switch all the time, that's going to be really bad for throughput. And a third metric I'm talking about is fairness. And fairness, well, all the other ones, I kind of have something you could probably measure. Like total work per second, not clear what work is, but like if I'm running like a simulation, it's like amount of time I've simulated. There you go. Now you've measured throughput. But fairness, I didn't give you anything to measure. Like, what does that mean? And usually we have an intuition about this. And there are multiple definitions where the details are different. But there's like common cases where we say that's not fair, like as far as treating the programs equally. And I say treating programs equally because I'm going back to that one program per user model. So if there's one program per user, we're being fair if we treat each user the same. Even though, as I said, that's not maybe what we actually care about on the modern system. So questions about these metrics from a high level. So something to know is that these metrics are in conflict. And this is most obvious with probably things like turnaround time and fairness and throughput and fairness. That being fair might mean switching between programs more, which is going to lower throughput. Lowering turnaround time might mean running some things earlier than others, which might lower fairness. Like, and generally we'll find that we probably need to choose which one we really care about. We're not going to be able to tick all these boxes. So I promised I'd give you a note about turnaround time. So this is an unfortunate vocabulary niche. So I have our recommended textbook and our suggested textbook, recommended textbook, Anderson Dahlin and Norpachi Dasu is the suggested textbook that's free online. And Anderson Dahlin calls the time from when a program is ready to when it finishes turnaround time. And there's another measurement called wait time, which is the time from when a program is ready to when it finishes that it's not running, called wait time. And these are both useful measurements. And for the most part, always if you're talking about mean turnaround time or total turnaround time, optimizing turnaround time is the same as optimizing wait time. but they are different numbers. And unfortunately, Anderson Dahlin calls this turnaround time quantity response time. And Arpeggi Dasu calls this wait time quantity response time. So I will try to use the terms turnaround time and wait time, and never use the term response time to avoid this ambiguity. And this is just a thing where the real world does not agree about what response time exactly measures, has an idea of the type of thing it measures, and that's what we got. But it mostly won't matter because we're going to talk about mean or total turnaround time, and optimizing that is the same as optimizing mean or total wait time. So there won't be a difference. Now, turnaround time is maybe less intuitive for why it's a nice and really important metric. And if we're thinking about scheduling CPU bursts, turnaround time you can think of as the time to start the next I.O. So I gave you the idea that it's like I press a key, it's when I see the output. That's part of it. But even if I'm thinking about something like a server with no like screen, this is how I get the most efficient use of my I.O. devices, because I want to make sure that they always have work to do. Minimizing turnaround time is going to help me do that by keeping them busy. So this is actually like a very useful thing to optimize, even if our system isn't interactive in the sense of a desktop, because it's going to get good efficiency and run things effectively. Okay, so questions about turnaround time? And turnaround time also applies to other contexts. So I mentioned for the batch program, just to back to that other example, like turnaround time is the user observed actual like end-to-end time. So like that's also like the right metric there, probably. So we'll talk about it for CPU bursts, but if the algorithm handles CPU bursts right, it might also be right for these other very different contexts. Throughput. So I mentioned throughput. The big issue is context switches. So let's say our context switch takes 0.5 units. In this case, we would say that, you know, we've lost 1 unit of time over these 3 plus 3 plus 2 units of actual work. So we have like 88% throughput in a sense. Now, throughput, as I said, we don't just directly measure the context switch time. We also have other considerations. The biggest one is going to be this time lost to cold caches. That, you know, if A was using the L1 cache, when it runs the second time, well, stuff isn't cached, it's going to run slower. And that's a very hard to measure cost, but it's a real cost that we'll call part of the overhead of our scheduler, because things would have run more efficiently if we just kept A running, made full use of that cache. Yes? The question is, does the time you do a context switch depend on the program size? So this depends on what you call part of the time you do a context switch. If we're measuring from, like in our scheduler, when we switch to the scheduler switches to another program, basically no. I say basically no, there's some issues like sometimes you might need to save more registers or something, but basically no. But commonly when people talk about the cost of a context switch, they try to include a reasonable estimate of this cold cache's cost, in which case, yes, it will vary a lot. Yes? The question is, are there systems which have separate caches for each process? This is generally not a thing you would do because you aren't fully utilizing the available storage in the hardware if you do that. Unless you have something like loading the caches or unloading them, which is possible, but I haven't heard of much hardware doing that outside of very specialized hardware like GPUs. Other questions?
Do multi-core processors prioritize running processes on the same CPU?
The question is, should we, on a multi-core processor should be prioritized running processes in the same CPU to reuse caches. This is something that the OS needs to do, not the processor, and absolutely. And that's one of the many considerations for multi-core scheduling that we won't talk about because we're not talking about multi-core scheduling much. Other questions? So that's throughput. We also had fairness. So here I have two possible schedules. And remember, I'm starting from our one program per user point of view for talking about fairness. That the picture might be a little more complicated when we're running like multiple processes. So which one of these is fairer? Who thinks the top one? The bottom one? Good. So we have an intuition. Even if we don't have a definition, which is going to work for all cases to define what fairness means, you all think, yeah, that second one is a lot fairer than the first one. There's something wrong with the first one that's unfair about it. So it's easy to answer in many cases like this. Formal definitions are trickier, especially because the formal definition needs to give, you know, we have all these variations, like which is more fair. And that's actually pretty tricky to do. And we probably won't go into many of the details of that. So questions on fairness. So we talked about a bunch of metrics, and these are going to be very important for deciding, well, what do you actually want to do for our schedulers? And since we've talked about these metrics, let's go through a little exercise here of just, you know, I haven't talked about scheduling policies yet explicitly, but here are some results of some presumed scheduling policies. And I have three programs. So program A uses the CPU for basically 2 units of time, needs to wait for the network for 3 units after that, and then runs for 1 more unit. Program B runs for 1 unit, and program C runs for 4. And they're all ready at the same time. So they're all ready when we begin. I have 3 different ways of running them. And my question is, which of these different schedules for running these is best for throughput, mean turnaround time, fairness, and responsiveness? And check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what you think the answer for each of those are. I guess responsiveness I didn't actually define. It's just I want your intuitive notion of like you're using a desktop which uses a scheduler which does these things. What do you think is most responsive?
I'm running.
Okay, so let's start with throughput. Anyone have an opinion on which you think is best for throughput? Okay.
One, because
there's the least context difference. Okay. So you're saying, so this is one, because of context switches. So your notion is context switches are a main cause of not getting useful work done. We have 1, 2, 3 context switches here. Everything else has more than 3, so that should have the best throughput. Okay. So how about mean turnaround time? Anyone with an answer for that? Back there? So 2. So how do you say 2? Okay, so you're saying it looks like I'm doing that. Okay, other opinions? So, yeah.
We got process. Or, yeah, 1.
Okay, so what is your logic there?
The time between starting and stopping each program was the shortest.
Okay, yeah. So the time between stopping and starting. So you said you had the right idea. You wanted the time starting, but we have to look at what that is. So one subtlety, which is easy to miss, is you might say, oh, B starts here and ends here, therefore that's its turnaround time. That's not how turnaround time works. B was ready to run here, so this is B's turnaround time, from the beginning to then. Because B was ready to run. Turnaround time is when we could have started running it to when it finished. So B was ready to run at the beginning, which we know because a possible schedule ran it first, till then. So that's B's turnaround time. And for A's turnaround time, remember turnaround time is, we're talking about CPU bursts. So this is where it gets a little tricky. So we can think of A's turnaround time in this example as being A started running here and finished running here. And then we had a second case where this was where its turnaround time was that, was 1 unit. So A has 2 turnaround times. And if you want the mean, you need to think about, wait, what does that mean if A runs twice? And I didn't tell you, so there might be multiple answers. And for C, C's turnaround time, C was runnable here, even though we didn't run it first in any of these schedules, and finished here. So this is C's turnaround time. Yeah?
What's the difference between turnaround time and responsiveness?
So the question is, what's the difference between turnaround time and responsiveness? That's a subjective question. But a reasonable estimate of responsiveness is best mean turnaround time. So going back to turnaround time, so the idea that 1 has lowest turnaround time, I believe, is correct. We have lower for B. We have lower for A the first time it runs, and the same for A, well, and higher for A the second time it runs, but we have the same for C. So I can see the case. So probably this is lower mean turnaround time because A is lower and B is lower than in 2. Though 2 is not horrible from that perspective. And next time we'll go through calculating turnaround times much more explicitly when we talk about simple schedulers that we're going to look over. Okay. And as I said, responsiveness looks like turnaround time. But you might make some decisions, like, you know, was it really hurting to not run B right away given that B wasn't waiting for IO afterwards? Like, there's some subjectivity there that makes it less of a clear call. How about fairness before we leave off? What do people think about fairness? Yeah. So why do you say 3? So everything's evenly divided. Any other opinions? Yeah. Two, because they alternate. So the complaint you might have with so 3 is fair in a certain sense, but some people would say, gosh, B is really left behind in 3. And this is a case which depends on your definition of fairness. Is it really bad for B to be delayed that long or not? Many definitions would say yes, some would say no. So next time we'll talk about some simple schedulers and look at how these metrics apply to them.